2017. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. It is amazing how quickly we transition from one year to the next. But note this, we are very careful as human beings to mark time. This is testimony to the fact that God made us, his human creatures, as temporal beings. We cannot think without reference to time. We are in a constant thoughtfulness in terms of past, present, and future. This is a very key issue in terms of the distinction between the Creator and the creature. The Creator is eternal. The creature is very temporal. We feel that temporality in our bones. We see it in the world all around us. Theologians refer to this as the infinite qualitative distinction between time and eternity. But, as the book of Ecclesiastes tells us, God has implanted within his human creatures a yearning for eternity. That's a testimony to his own existence and to the fact that we are made in his image. One of the things we need to note is that human beings, as chronological creatures, need to mark time. And that marking of time has a great deal to do with the fact that we mark the new year. And we celebrate that in terms of the passage of time, reflecting on the year past and looking forward to the future. And that, of course, is the year 2017. No longer the future, but now very much the present. 3 days into 2017, it is already clear that this will be a significant year, as virtually every year is. But right now, in the United States, all eyes are on the incoming presidential administration of Donald Trump. There was at least some break from the political speculation and from the political headlines over the Christmas and New Year's holiday, but it was a very brief respite from the constant barrage of headlines we're going to face as we now move toward January the 20th and the presidential inauguration. At the same time, we have to recognize this means that we are watching the waning days of the presidential administration of Barack Obama. And make no mistake, President Obama has signaled that he intends to make news right up into the very end of his administration. And furthermore, he has sent strong signals that he intends to continue to be involved in American politics. Something a bit strange for an outgoing president, but this is also a president who has announced that he will continue to live in Washington, D.C. We should note carefully that the last president to decide to live in D.C. after his administration was Woodrow Wilson, virtually a century ago. In coming days, we'll take a closer look at issues and events related to both the incoming and the outgoing presidential administrations. That's going to frame most of the cultural and political news in the United States, at least for the next 2 to 3 weeks. On the global scene, over the Christmas and New Year's holidays, there were terror attacks in cities like Berlin and Istanbul. In Istanbul, on New Year's Eve, terrorists attacked a nightclub that included people gathered from at least 18 to 19 different nations. In Berlin, the terror attack took place just before Christmas, and it was claimed by the Islamic State. Once again, a terrorist drove a truck into a crowd, this time people who were gathered in a Christmas marketplace right in front of Berlin's historic Kaiser Wilhelm Kirche, that is, the Kaiser Wilhelm Church. This location is one of the most iconic in Berlin, tying together Imperial Germany, Nazi Germany, and modern Germany. It is named for one of the last emperors of what we now know as Imperial Germany, and then it was rebuilt after being destroyed by Allied bombing as a symbol of the destructiveness that was brought on Germany by Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich. It is also a symbol of modern Germany, its modern architecture in terms of the church behind that very historic tower that was so damaged by Allied bombing. And thus, this was more than just a crowd chosen at random. This was an attack upon the very idea of Berlin and the very idea of Germany. Also in headlines just before Christmas, an assassin killed the Russian ambassador to Turkey, even as the ambassador was speaking at the opening of an art exhibition in Ankara, Turkey's modern capital. These headlines, along with ominous others, remind us of the unsettled state of the world. It's a world that appears to be becoming more and not less unsettled, a world in which terrorism poses greater and not lesser threats, not only in other parts of the world, but right here as well. And, of course, when we're looking at the world scene, at least some took note of the fact that the United Nations now has a new leader, a new Secretary General. Antonio Guterres was the former Prime Minister of Portugal. He was also formerly head of the United Nations refugee programs. I said few people took notice, and that's because if you took a poll, very few Americans, almost assuredly, have any idea of the name of the Secretary General of the United Nations, either the new Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, or the outgoing Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. The reason for that is quite simple. The United Nations is not that important. The United Nations, as we know it today, is a successor to what was hoped to be the League of Nations after the disaster of World War I. That was championed by then American President Woodrow Wilson, who in the end was unable to sell the idea even to the United States Senate. But fast forward to the end of World War II, and the idea was resurrected once again by the triumphant Allied powers. And they put together what we now know as the United Nations in the hope that some kind of transnational, even multinational government would create a new era of world peace. To state the matter bluntly, it hasn't happened. Rather than becoming a very effective global authority, the United Nations has become increasingly discredited and shown to be increasingly incompetent. Looking through the lens of a Christian worldview, we come to understand that the very idea of a global government is very problematic. It is, according to a biblical worldview, far more likely to eventuate in some form of autocratic power or bureaucratic inefficiency rather than in any kind of government that would function to bring about peace and stability and prosperity. The biblical doctrine of sin functions to remind us of the dangers of pretensions to power and of the accumulation of power. The very idea of a global government brings a haunting realization that any government that would have the power to rule over the entire globe would be a government that would end up in tyranny, almost by definition. It would also end up in incompetence, and that's because problems at the human level, at the human scale, cannot be solved globally. They can only be addressed and sometimes resolved locally. This is the principle of subsidiarity that reminds us that the government that will govern best is the government that is closest to where human beings live. It is also a reminder that as we look at the spheres of responsibility and authority that God has given us, you can't solve a problem, for instance, that emerges with the breakdown of the family by any kind of imposition of government. And furthermore, a government that might be headquartered, say, in Brussels or in Geneva or in Washington, D.C., for that matter, is not a government that can adequately and competently address problems, very real human problems, on a human scale, virtually anywhere in the world beyond its site. And when you get the representatives of 193 different governments together in one room in the UN General Assembly, or even represented in the UN Security Council, you really do not have 193 voices. Rather, you have a constellation of networks and special interests and power blocks. All this is a recipe for disaster, as we saw, affirmed and underlined in recent days with UN Resolution 2334, a resolution having to do with the State of Israel. A resolution we will look at more closely in days to come. But in this first edition of the briefing for the year 2017, the year in which we will observe the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, among other very important remembrances, we also need to recognize that December the 25th, Christmas Day of last year, marked the 25th anniversary of one of the most important events in our lifetimes, the fall of the Soviet Union. It tells us something that 25 years after the fall of the Soviet Union, there was so little attention to what is, by any estimation, a monumental event in terms of world history. The Soviet Union intended to dominate the world, and for many decades during the 20th century, it appeared that it just might. This is an anniversary that is not only of importance in terms of history, but also in terms of worldview analysis, because the death of the Soviet Union should have spelled the death of Marxism, and in particular, the death of communism. But as we shall see, it actually did not. To understand the fall of the Soviet Union, you have to go back to its birth, especially in the Bolshevik Revolution in the second decade of the 20th century. You go back to the years 1918 to 1919 and come to understand that even as the 20th century was born out of the ruins of the 19th, on the left, the two major competing worldviews were Marxism and anarchism. And, as we shall see, it was Marxism that gained the upper hand. Karl Marx, one of the most important philosophical minds of the 19th century, along with his colleague Friedrich Engels, wrote what was called the Communist Manifesto. But Marx also offered a nearly comprehensive worldview, a worldview that was based upon atheism and upon the idea of Hegelian dialectics. That is, going back to Georg Friedrich Hegel, the idea that history moves in terms of a sequence of thesis and antithesis and eventually synthesis. Marx looked around the world as he saw it in the 19th century and identified the major dynamic in terms of human activity as economics. And he identified the economic oppression of those who were without capital, that is, without major private property, as being the major dynamic of human oppression. He saw capitalism as the thesis. He then saw a form of revolution, even a violent revolution, as the antithesis. The synthesis that he promised that would inevitably come out of a communist revolution would be a communist utopia. After the thesis would come the revolutionary antithesis. And after the antithesis would come a new era of prosperity and peace under the rule of the people, known as the Soviet. Of course, all this came by means of a bloody revolution led by Vladimir Lenin and his theorist Leon Trotsky. And, of course, the revolution was bloody from the start, as had been prophesied by both Marx and Lenin. Within months of the beginning of the revolution, the royal family had been murdered, including the Tsar Nicholas II, the Tsarina Alexandra, the young Tsarevich, her crown prince, and all of the Russian princesses. The revolutionaries went on to murder a great deal of the Russian nobility. But this is not where they stopped, and this is one of the most profound lessons of our times. By the time the Soviet Union fell, at least officially, in 1991, the death toll of that revolution and the revolutionary governments that followed would amount to tens of millions, perhaps even over 100 million dead. Rather than bringing about a stable and prosperous regime that honored human rights and human dignity and freedom, the Bolshevik Revolution actually led to one of the most oppressive regimes that also ended up with world power that has ever taken place in history. Overall, the verdict on the Soviet Union is that rather than bringing prosperity, it brought poverty. Rather than bringing freedom, it brought oppression. Rather than bringing about the arrival of a new utopia of communism, instead it led to one of the most brutal regimes repressing its own people. And furthermore, it even led to a complete distortion of morality. The Soviet regime claimed for the state ultimate authority and loyalty, seeking to turn even children against their parents and husbands against wives, wives against husbands, generation against generation. It was an officially atheistic state. Even as Karl Marx understood religion as the opiate of the people, the Soviets sought to crack down on all religious expression, but most particularly on Christianity. The state effectively idolized itself, much as had the Roman Empire, in which Caesar claimed to be God. In the Soviet Union, it was claimed that there was no God, and that all that was left was the Supreme Soviet, acting on behalf of the people. We also need to understand that in the name of equality, the communists put together a system of government and a state-controlled system of economics that was, if anything, even more unequal in terms of economics than had been the system criticized by Karl Marx even in the 19th century. This led George Orwell, one of the prophetic voices of the 20th century, in his famous novella, Animal Farm, to state that all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others, aptly summarizing the morality and the economic system of the Soviet regime. Economically, the Soviet Union was a spectacular failure, but it was a far more serious moral failure. By the time you get to the dictatorship of Joseph Stalin in the middle decades of the 20th century, the Soviet Union has fallen into even greater moral disaster with purges of the party and show trials, with summary executions. It is estimated that tens of millions of persons died under the regime of Joseph Stalin, sometimes for no obvious reason whatsoever. In the moral formula of the Soviet Union, once you were declared to be an enemy of the state, you became effectively a non-person. You simply disappeared. The Soviets maintained oppressive party control with an entire system of political prisons known as gulags. Some of the most horrifying narratives of the 20th century came from those few who survived the experience of being imprisoned in one of those gulags. You also have to look at the fact that at the end of World War II and throughout almost the rest of the 20th century, the main issue in terms of the world dynamic is what was known as the Cold War. It was an epic battle between two great superpowers, the United States, allied with modern Western democratic governments in the West, and the Soviet bloc, headed by the USSR, or the Soviet Union. They were competing not only for territory, but for souls, and for minds, and for political influence around the world. One of the noteworthy arenas of that competition was, we simply have to note, the floor of the General Assembly and the Security Council of the United Nations. But the Cold War was sinister in so many other ways as well. At the end of World War II, Joseph Stalin took the opportunity, with the collapse of Nazi Germany, to claim much of the property that Mother Russia had coveted for so long. This included the nations of the so-called Soviet bloc in Eastern Europe that included not only a good portion of Germany, but also Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, and a host of other nations. And sometimes the Soviet Union just baldly claimed and grabbed power and land, such as in the Baltic republics. The great horrifying symbol of the Soviet Union was actually not in Russia at all, but in Germany, in the city of Berlin. The Berlin Wall that went up early in the 1960s, dividing the city of Berlin virtually in half, a wall that came to represent not only the communist government of East Germany and, furthermore, the evil intentions of the Soviet Union, but the very reality that this totalitarian regime was willing to put up a wall in which to imprison its own people and to shoot and to kill anyone who sought to leave that territory. In the bigger picture, the seeds for the destruction of the Soviet Union were sown by the Soviets in their own revolution and in their own tyranny. But we also have to note for the historical record that in terms of the battle of worldviews, there arose a very different situation in the 1980s with the arrival on the world scene of three very powerful personalities who were willing to stare down the Soviet Union and the ideology of communism. Those three were British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the American President Ronald Reagan, and Pope John Paul II. In the last case, we were looking at the fact that breaking centuries of tradition, the Roman Catholic Church elected a Polish pope. That may seem less significant now than it was then, because in electing a Polish pope, they were electing an enemy of communism and an opponent of the communist regime there in Poland. It requires no theological compromise to recognize that on the world scene, Pope John Paul II was a very effective prophetic voice against communist tyranny. But so were Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. And when they arrived on the political scene, especially the height of their powers in the 1980s, both of them understood not only that communism was an evil ideology, but that the Soviet Union could be a temporary reality. Winds of change began to become very apparent, blowing through the Kremlin and elsewhere, during the late 1980s when Mikhail Gorbachev became the president of the Soviet Union and the head of the Communist Party. He brought about what was called a process of perestroika, or change within the Soviet Union, and it was basically an admission of the failure of the Soviets to deliver on their promises. But it was more than that. In economic terms, Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan led an arms race that effectively made clear to the Soviet Union that it was not only technologically backward, but that economically it simply could not keep up with the NATO powers and especially with the United States. In political terms, it also became clear that the Soviet Union and its leadership was losing confidence in the very idea of the Soviet Union. And when winds of freedom began to circulate amongst peoples in Eastern Europe and even within Russia, the Soviet Union lost the will to oppress them. Seizing the opportunity, parties of freedom gained control in several of the satellite states. The Eastern European governments that had been a part of the Eastern Bloc began to distance themselves from the Soviet Union, and eventually the Russian Federation replaced the Soviet Union in terms of the power that was at the center of the government. The Soviet Union effectively ceased to exist on Christmas Day of 1991. One of the things we need to recognize 25 years later is the danger of failing to remember the horrifying lessons of the Soviet Union, and furthermore, the horrifying lessons of the communist revolutions. We also need to recognize with embarrassment that a good many Western liberals saw the idea of a communist revolution and even of the Bolshevik revolution as a brand new adventure that would lead to great promise on the world scene. One of the most famous of these was Lincoln Steffens, an American reporter, who reported back from the Bolshevik Revolution saying, "I have seen the future and it works," end quote. Of course, it did not work. In 1919, Lincoln Steffens apologized for the Soviet Union, saying that Soviet Russia was a revolutionary government with an evolutionary plan. In other words, he was saying, "Wait and see, and when you see, it will work." He explained away the bloody tyranny of the revolution by calling it, quote, "a temporary condition of evil, which is made tolerable by hope and a plan," end quote. Well, the hope disappeared and the plan was a colossal failure. The philosophical and political left in both Europe and the United States continued to serve as apologists for communism in general, for Marxism as a philosophy, and even for the Soviet Union, virtually until the fall of the USSR 25 years ago. Writing concerning this anniversary in the Wall Street Journal, Andrew Clark, the executive director of a group known as Generation Opportunity, he himself a millennial, asked the question, "Is communism cool?" And then he says, "If you dare, ask a millennial," pointing to the fact that many millennials in the United States and in Europe today have a romanticized idea about not only the Soviet Union and communism, but about Marxism in particular. He writes, quote, "Millennials are one of history's luckiest generations. We were fortunate to be born around the end of the Cold War a quarter century ago when the tyrannical communism embodied in the Soviet Union came tumbling down, also knocking socialism down a few pegs along the way. We have grown up in a world," he writes, "where for the most part, economic and personal freedom are the rule rather than the exception." And then he continues, quote, "and apparently we hate it. How else does one explain why so many millennials seem to long to live in a government-run economy or worse?" Part of the background of Clark's concern, of course, is the unexpected popularity of the openly declared Democratic Socialist candidate Bernie Sanders running for the Democratic presidential nomination. As Clark points out, many of the young followers of Bernie Sanders actually have no idea what socialism actually is, nor how socialism actually played out on the ground. They often point to Scandinavian countries and cultures as those that they would wish the United States to emulate without recognizing that those Scandinavian countries actually abandoned socialism decades ago, something not brought to our attention by Senator Sanders. Clark concludes his essay by writing, quote, "Young people living in communist and socialist countries today don't deserve U.S. millennials' envy, but their concern and pity. There was nothing to admire about the Soviet Union, and there is even less to admire in countries that seek to perpetuate its failed philosophy at the expense of liberty and prosperity. Our generation," he concludes, "is lucky it hasn't learned this firsthand, and let's hope we never have to," end quote. I hold in my hand just now the transcript of a conversation that took place between Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev and the American President George H.W. Bush that began at 10:03 a.m. on Christmas Day of 1991. In that conversation, as it took its most crucial turn, President Gorbachev said to President Bush, quote, "I have here on my desk a decree of the President of the USSR on my resignation. I will also resign my duties as Commander-in-Chief and will transfer authority to use the nuclear weapons to the President of the Russian Federation. So I am conducting affairs until the completion of the constitutional process. I can assure you that everything is under strict control," end quote. President Gorbachev continued, quote, "As soon as I announce my resignation, I will put these decrees into effect. There will be no disconnection. You can have a very quiet Christmas evening," end quote. And so, to quote the poet, "the Soviet Union fell, we should be thankful, not with a bang, but with a whimper." And with, ironically and tellingly enough, a call that came from the president of the Soviet Union informing the president of the United States that he was resigning and his government was collapsing, and then wishing the American president a Merry Christmas. In this first edition of the briefing for the year 2017, I would argue we dare not miss the lessons and the worldview implications of that anniversary that took place just a few days ago, the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Soviet Union, Christmas Day, 2016. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from West Palm Beach, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.